I'm Amy Hall. I'm here with Greg Kokel, and you're listening to Stand to Reasons, hashtag STR Ask podcast. Hello, Greg.
Good morning, Amy.
Let's start with a question from Bird. Do intersex...
As in bird, like B-I-R-D?
B-I-R-D, yes.
Oh, okay.
Do intersex people get to decide what gender they are? How about choosing to be non-binary? This gray zone is very important to address because it leads a lot of people to accept that gender is identity and not biology, let alone design.
Well, the problem here, and this just goes back to an old saw that is applicable in a lot of areas, not just politics, which is where it comes up. And that aphorism is that hard cases make bad policy. And the point there is you do not look at an individual's difficulty and then make decisions for everybody because of an individual's difficulty. Hard cases make bad policy. Now, of course, rhetorically, this is done all the time. And some politician wants to see some policy advanced, and so he trots somebody across the stage who tells a story. All right. The question is, what is good for the most, what applies, what is good for and applies to most people most of the time? In this case, intersex is very, very rare. So we don't make decisions about what sex is when you have the very rare and odd sexual anomaly or ambiguity. And in intersex, you have a circumstance in where an individual is born with a congenital defect in which the sex is anomalous. It's not entirely clear. All right? There's a problem. There's a mistake. Now what? Well, you have to make a decision on that individual's problem, but the decision you make on that individual's problem is not generalized to all healthy, normal people who are born with unambiguous sexual organs. And see, this is the move rhetorically here. Not that this is not what Bird is saying in her or his, is it a male or a female bird? I guess that's the wrong question to even ask in this kind of, in any event, but I don't know that this is the Bird's point of view. But the point is, in the vast majority of cases, there is no ambiguity, and so we generalize based on the vast majority of cases. And in the odd case where there is a sexual ambiguity, then decisions need to be made. Sometimes one sex is favored over another in the physical body. And I don't know a lot about this. So I have to be careful I don't speak out of my ken. But the general thing is a decision is made by the parents and the doctor as to which direction this child would go. And the reason is human beings are bisexual and society is geared for bisexual human. Okay, bisexual, that's not the right word.
That's a little confusing word.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Dimorphic.
Human beings. Thank you. Sexually dimorphic. I saw Amos cringe there and grimace, and then I realized, okay, what I said can be misunderstood because of the way the language is used. Human beings are have binary sexuality or sexually dimorphic, as what Amy said. We have two sexes. That's human beings have two sexes, male and female. And even with all of the unjustified public pressure to shift sexuality from the body to the mind, culture still is geared for binary sexuality in human beings. And the attempts to change that have disastrous consequences, social consequences. And people are pretty clear on that, except for the people who are advancing the foolishness. All right? And so therefore, when somebody is has a sexuality that is ambiguous when they're born, it makes sense for them to adopt one sex or the other to live by. And if that requires some medical help, that's not a problem. I don't have any difficulty with that. So they move that person in that right direction. Are sometimes further problems come out of that? Yeah, but like I said, hard cases make bad policy. And so we have to deal with the hard cases on an individual basis and make policy based on what is generally true of the vast majority of people, all right? Those who are advancing this concept of gender flexibility are trade sometimes on these anomalies, and I don't think we shouldn't be taken in by that. Just because there are exceptions to the rule doesn't mean there's not a rule. And as I've said many times before regarding this issue, just because the culture is confused does not mean we need to be confused, all right? God made them male and female. And incidentally, you don't need the Bible to know that. This is common sense. And so don't let others pressure you to abandon common sense. Mm-hmm. It will serve you well in like 99.9% of the cases you encounter.
One thing also, the reason why we know there are two sexes is because our reproduction systems have a function. They have a function. You need male and female to come together in order for that function, to be healthy and work, you have to have the two come together. And that's it.
This is the only function, by the way, of a physical body that's like that. All the other functions operate individually except for the sexual function.
Right. There's no third option. There are the two options. They work together. They accomplish their goal.
Incidentally, Amy, if I could, the only people I say, what about in vitro? Well, in vitro is just the location. You still need a man and a woman.
Right. So if there is somebody that doesn't fall into that category because of a genetic problem, that doesn't change the fact that there are two. It just means that their reproductive system is not functioning correctly. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be able to function in the way that human beings are meant to function. So think about somebody who's born without limbs. Now, if somebody's born without limbs, that doesn't mean that human beings are no longer the kinds of creatures that have two arms and two legs. It doesn't change that. And nobody thinks that way. So why would we think that way about this? And further, if that person who has no arms and legs, well, that person can decide, am I going to have artificial limbs and look like a person with all my limbs, or am I not going to do that? But his decision, his mental decision about that, doesn't change the fact that human beings are the kinds of creatures that have two arms and two legs. Mm-hmm. So sometimes just looking at this in terms of other things that are clear to us because they aren't so politically charged makes it a lot easier to understand what we're talking about here. We're talking about people who have genetic defects and are not developing the way human beings are meant to develop.
You know, Amy, it's such a great illustration about arms and legs. So obvious. But let's take it a step further. There are people who are born genetically that are defective in that way. I think defective is the right word. We all know that. They're not defective human beings. They have defective bodies, okay? There is a Christian guy. No arms, no legs. I can't remember his name. Maybe you do, but
I can never remember his last name. People are probably yelling at it right now.
He lives in my area, and one of our speakers is on his board for his organization because he has an evangelistic organization. But because there's an individual born without arms and legs, would this tempt us to think, Well, having arms and legs aren't an ordinary or normal part of being human. Therefore, I can have mine amputated. There are some people who think that, by the way, but we realize how foolish that is. And, I mean, there may be someone on the extreme that is arguing for bodily autonomy and saying, well, he should or she should be allowed to do that because it's their choice. But that's not really my point. My point isn't whether it's their choice or not. My point is whether the kind of the mental equation is appropriate. That because some people are born without limbs, that means having limbs is not part of being human, and we can just decide whether or not we want to have limbs, like changing our hair color or something like that. That's nutty.
Mm-hmm.
Not changing our hair color, but deciding what limbs we can have just because there are some anomalies, people born without them.
And in fact, I don't think doctors are allowed to remove limbs from the people who have that problem. And I'm blanking on the name of it right now, but there are people who do think that in their minds there's someone who doesn't have a left arm, and therefore they want a doctor to cut it off. And doctors right. refuse to do that. At least they have in the past. I don't know if that's changed, because that's no different than this. If you are saying you're a different sex and you want healthy body parts removed, that's no different than the person who wants their arm removed because they see themselves as someone without an arm.
Yeah, just to clarify, they self-identify as a one-armed person and want the doctor to remove the other arm, the extra arm, the arm that they believe they don't have.
And the medical community has frowned on that.
Yeah, well.
So it's just amazing how much changes in worldview about human beings and the idea that we are not created to be in a certain way. These can infect our ideas about everything. And suddenly we're unable to see how irrational some of these objections are.
Mm-hmm.
So that... Just try and put it in a different category and find the principle and see if it works. I think that can sometimes be helpful to people. Let's go on to a question from Matt. Since we are spiritual creatures joined with a physical body that can affect our spirit and vice versa, could physical damage to our bodies prevent us from experiencing a sense of God? I know God can choose to communicate with or without a feeling associated. Just curious how to think about such claims.
Yeah, I think that's possible. In fact, I'm trying to think back now. This is these are ramifications of the broader category, philosophically known as the mind-body problem. And the mind-body problem is broadly the question of whether there is a mind and a body or just a body. Okay? And, of course, physicalists think there is no mind. There is no soul. There are just bodies that have certain qualities and functions, okay? And one of those functions are thoughts, and those thoughts are bottom up. In other words, your thoughts aren't doing things to your body, your thoughts aren't choosing, but your body is the physical thing that is real that's just creating these thoughts in different ways, and they're characterized in different fashions. So that's what this is broadly about. And if you're a dualist, as the gentleman has suggested, that you believe there's a physical body and an immaterial self, the soul or spirit, mind, if you will, that there is an interaction because of the unity, so one interferes or one can affect the other. And then the question becomes, can these things have an impact on our spiritual thinking? And I think the answer is definitely. In fact, this is part of what we were talking about in an earlier show. Humans go through physical suffering, and this has a ramification on the way they understand God. So it does affect our beliefs. You know, they're not determinative. It isn't like this is a automatic reaction, but there is a relationship there. And as I recall, I could be mistaken about this because my own studies, intense studies on this, happened over 20 years ago under J.P. Moreland. But as I recall, I think he mentioned there are circumstances where the body can be so impaired that it can have an influence on our belief in God or our thinking about God or something like that. People have gone through, as I recall, have had accidents that injured their brains so much that their attitudes or their convictions about God's existence changed. And it wasn't, as I recall, because how could there be a God that he would allow this to happen to me? Not that kind. But it just changed their thinking process. There is a area of the brain where these kinds of activities, I want to be careful how I say this. I was going to say take place, but your mental activities don't take place in your brain. Your mental activities are correlated with activities in your brain. They're not in your head, but there's a unity, so there are parts of the brain that correlate to other things. And so if that area that correlates to religious conviction is damaged, I think it certainly is possible for that to alter the ability to think properly and clearly about spiritual things, including God.
Well, and specifically here, he's not talking about thinking, but rather a, quote, sense of God. Does that...
Yeah,
what do you think of that? Same thing?
Well, I would think in principle, I would think that's possible. Whether this actually works out quite the same way, I don't know. But certainly in principle, that's possible. And that damage to that area of the brain seems to have in the past affected people's religious convictions or senses or whatever. I can't speak directly to that issue, but in general, there's a relationship.
And luckily, as he noted, God can communicate without feelings. He's communicated an objective message to all of us in the Bible. So even if that were the case, you would still have all of this. Now, I think about someone like David Wood. He has no empathy. He suffers from I don't know what exactly.
Is he a sociopath or psychopath? Or maybe he's a little of both. But Christian Brother, who we know and actually quite famous now for a number of reasons, as an apologist.
His testimony online is amazing. You should go look for that on his YouTube. But
by the way, it's called David Wood: Why I Am a Christian.
Yes,
so I need to know.
I definitely recommend it. It's quite amazing. But the point is, here's somebody who doesn't experience the same emotions as everyone else, and yet he is following God purely on an intellectual basis. So he's deciding to do what's right because God says it's right, not necessarily because he feels it's right or he feels a desire to do it. I don't know exactly how this all works out, but His emotions have definitely been damaged in some way. And yet he is still following God because he can look at it and know that it is true and therefore follow it along. Now, in our culture, the idea is that everybody follows their feelings. So this is kind of an unusual idea, but it can be done and it is done.
By the way, I don't know that David is... Well, I know he's not emotionless because he loves Marie, his wife, and his boys, and et cetera, et cetera. But there certainly is a damage that's done there. And I don't even know what his interior life about God is, but we know this thing is functioning in a
right,
or not functioning the way it normally would. So the point is a good one. I don't want to make David Wood an emotional blank state.
It's like, well,
he might get mad at me.
No.
Bad joke.
I don't know how it all works out. I've just heard him say various things about the difficulties of this. So, I recommend you take a look at his website. He's done a few different videos talking about this, and they've all been quite interesting.
Right.
And
we went to Israel together 2 years ago, and he's a Muslim apologist. That is, he deals with Islam, and he's like bold on border on the border of being insane in his boldness, and partly maybe affected to this. But there were multiple times in Jerusalem where people would come up to him because they recognized him.
Oh, wow.
That's how, in a, you know, how well known he is in his particular field. So, but he's magnificent in what he does, and a very unique person. And I thank God for him. So, anyway, there you go, David.
It certainly shows the power of God. I mean, his story is amazing. So again, I recommend that video. Right. Well, thank you for listening. Thank you, Greg. And thank you for sending in your questions. Send them on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk or through our website. Use the hashtag STRAsk there, all one word, and we will see your question and hopefully we will get to yours. Thank you for listening. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.